This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. At the upcoming Olympic Games in Athens, perhaps nobody has more to win than swimmer Michael Phelps. He will be trying to tie or even break Mark Spitz's record of 7 gold medals set at the 1972 Games. Phelps has entered in 5 individual events and figures to swim in 3 relays. In his best events, he has been characterized as, quote, ridiculously dominant. In the rest of the events in which Phelps will swim, the world record holders might be charitably described as concerned. In an article that will run in tomorrow's New York Times Magazine, Michael Sokolov has profiled Michael Phelps. Mr. Sokolov joins me now from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Michael Phelps is 19 years old. How long has he been swimming 5 to 7 hours a day, 365 days a year?
Since he was 11 years old, he entered that kind of training. He's been a little swim machine for many years now.
So many athletes who begin single-minded training very early, no matter in what sport, run out of gas in their middle or late teens. What has kept Michael Phelps interested in a routine that many would consider monotonous beyond description at best?
Well, he's ideally constructed to swim, and he met with a lot of success early on. And he didn't meet with a lot of success in other parts of his life necessarily. Life outside the water in various ways is a struggle for Michael and has been a struggle for Michael. So the water is really his place in some sort of almost primitive way. And I think that Michael has felt that. And as he's gotten more success, the training part of it, he's very invested in. Each practice, each length of the pool for him holds some interest in a way that many of the rest of us wouldn't recognize.
Well, that brings up a question that may be a little scary. Do you think Michael Phelps has any idea what he'll do with all the time he's been spending in the water once he stops swimming? Because the greatest understatement in your article has to be, quote, his schedule has not left much time for pursuing outside interests.
I don't think that Michael has probably given that a whole lot of thought. First of all, he's just turned 19. And he really can be a swimmer at this level for most of the next decade, maybe even longer. So I think that Michael feels that he's going to stay in the water for a pretty long time. And like a lot of 19-year-olds, you know, he doesn't have a whole lot of advanced planning to begin with.
Your article suggests that some of the other Olympic swimmers, Americans among them, regard Michael Phelps as something of a medal hog. How has he handled that perception?
You know, he won't say how he's handled it. I think he's a little bit stung by it. I'm sure that he expected some resentment from the rest of the world. I think what he found at the Olympic trials was a core of older swimmers, 2, 3, 4 years older, many of them friends, many of them from the University of Texas. There are 3 world record holders there. Mm-hmm. And their resentment of Michael is not very far beneath the surface. And I feel a little bit sorry for him, to tell you the truth, because I don't think he deserves anyone's resentment. I think he's a beautiful and a great athlete, and I think he's doing what he needs to do, which is going for, you know, as much as he can go for. Otherwise, he would be bored.
You do say in the article at one point he's so good at his best events that he has to kind of come down a step to other people's best events in order to find any competition at all.
Absolutely. He's so dominant in the 200 and 400-meter individual medleys, which is the combination of 4 strokes, and the 200 butterfly, so far beyond the rest of the world. What would keep him practicing? What would keep him interested if he didn't go beyond those 3 dominant events?
You write that the shape and the proportions of Michael Phelps's body help in large measure to explain his success. Be a little specific for me there.
Well, Michael has big feet. He's size 14 feet. A lot of swimmers have big feet. But Michael has this weird hyperflexibility, what some people call double-jointed. So those feet almost go parallel to his shins. So he's got these big flippers. And in addition to that, he's got a weird body proportion where his upper body is the torso of a man 6'8", although he's only 6'4", and he has very short legs. And it's the legs that create drag or resistance in the water. So he's got this large, broad torso to create power, but not so much of a lower body to carry through the water. It's a tremendous advantage. There are very few people with his build.
His body type, his build, and his remarkable ability to recover quickly from his exertions in the pool led you to characterize swimming as, quote, the true calling of Michael Phelps. There's a real religious tone to that phrase. Does Phelps himself see swimming in that way?
I think that he does. I think that Michael sensed early on that he has a true gift, the kind of gift that very few people have in this world. You know, he is a water creature. He loves the water. He has a natural way of moving through it. A teammate has said to me, what the rest of us had to learn to do in the water, Michael knew the moment he got into it. And I know that Michael senses that. Therefore, I think he's quite happy to be in the water. I mean, it's certainly has brought him some money and some acclaim, but I think he has a comfort in the water which he identified, even if he could not put into words, at a very early age.
You tell one story in the article about how he had returned. I guess he'd been in Europe. He came home. He was jet-lagged. It was 3 a.m. He couldn't sleep. And he called up his coach at 3 a.m. and said, hey, I got to get to some water. I want to go swimming.
Well, that's right. I mean, he is in the water nearly every day. He's been out of the water 5 days in the last 7 years. That means 5 days without at least one practice. So this was going to be one of those days, you know, jet-lagged back from Japan. But he couldn't sleep, and he just wouldn't feel quite right unless he was wet. So he got in contact with his coach. They opened up the pool, and there he was in the water.
Finally, in your article, you characterize Michael Phelps as often appearing to be much younger than his years. As you say, he's 19. You call him at one point in the story, quote, a boy in a chlorine bubble. It may be too early to speculate about this, but how well does somebody who's lived this way since he was 11 come out of that chlorine bubble someday when the time comes?
That's a good question. I think that it's going to be difficult. Swimming is a monastic lifestyle. Michael has lived it even more than most. He's going to go to the University of Michigan next year where his coach is going to become the head coach. He's not going to be able to swim there because he's a pro, but he's going to still swim with the same coach, and he's going to live the college life away from his mother, away from this cocoon in Baltimore, theoretically away from the hovering coach. The coach says he'll change. You know, who knows how that's going to go? A lot of kids go to college and sort of freak out. Well, Michael has more to sort of maybe freak out or rebel against than most because he hasn't lived life as most teenagers have lived it.
Michael Sokolov's article, The Making of Michael Phelps, will appear in tomorrow's Sunday New York Times Magazine. Michael Sokolov is also the author of The Ticket Out, Daryl Strawberry and the Boys of Crenshaw. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you again.
In 6 days, the relative quiet that Athens has enjoyed since more than 100 years ago when the last summer games took place in Greece will be broken by the Sturm of tourism and the Drang of hype. From Athens, Joanna Kakissis reports.
Athens is usually a quiet place in August when many of its nearly 5 million residents leave for beach vacations on the islands and quiet moonlit walks in the villages. The relentless noise of automobile traffic is temporarily overshadowed by the growling engines of ferries leaving the port of Pylia. In open-air markets near the city, vendors sell fresh vegetables and fish, pirated music, Bangladeshi jewelry, and Russian tablecloth. Furniture salesman and his blue-eyed wife drive by in a truck loaded with chairs. Through a loudspeaker, he offers good prices. People buy what they need and they take the train home. The city's old train system was connected to the new metro system for the Olympics. The ride home is hot, loud, and quick. Thank you. Under a sky bruised by a purple and orange sunset, boys play an impromptu game of soccer in a park near a cafe serving ouzo. In the distance, the Acropolis glows with the last drops of daylight. A week before the 2004 games begin, the venues are finished. After months of round-the-clock construction, the noise is abed. Outside the Olympic Stadium, a ring of police officers and Greek soldiers stand guard. The sound of machinery has given way to rock music playing on a loudspeaker and police helicopters flying overhead. The Olympics are almost here. For Only a Game, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. On Monday, the call went out for a serious sports fan determined to make the record book, or at least for somebody with nothing better to do for at least a few days than watch TV. NBC, which will be presenting 1,200 hours worth of Olympics coverage later this month, is looking for somebody to watch more than 55 hours of that coverage without a break. That sort of perseverance in the front of the TV screen would shatter the record for consecutive hours of TV watching. A distinction NBC apparently feels should belong to a sports fan, rather than, say, somebody addicted to The Apprentice. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the naked truth about ancient Olympians. But first, the game of ping pong began as an English parlor activity some 120 years ago. Today, the sport, which its adherents prefer to call table tennis, is the second most popular in the world, trailing only soccer. Though the United States has been slow to take the sport beyond its status as a social diversion played in basements, there are Americans who are giving table tennis a new spin. Next week, Californian Kwa Nguyen and six other American table tennis players will represent the United States in Athens. Reporter Jason Margolis of member station KQED recently met with Nguyen, and he has our story.
Throughout Asia and parts of Europe, the top table tennis stars are sports icons. Their matches are broadcast in prime time, and the best players can earn close to $1 million a year through tournaments, sponsorships, and league play. In America, the best of the best toil in relative anonymity. The most famous American table tennis star is the fictional movie character Forrest Gump.
I like that movie. Obviously, a lot of people have seen it, and they come up to me all the time and say, you know, can you play like that?
That's 37-year-old Kwa Nguyen, who claims he'd probably give his fictional counterpart a run for his money. He trains for about 4 to 6 hours a day at his parents' home in Santa Clara. Today, his coach and older brother, Roger Nguyen, stands on the opposite side of the net and feeds him balls in rapid-fire drills. Kwa smashes them back, and balls bounce all over the concrete floor. The 5-foot-9-inch tall Nguyen nimbly jumps around the court, alternating shots between the corners of the table. He lands the majority of his returns inside small rubber circles, roughly 8 inches in diameter, laid on the table for practice drills. Wynn's forehand loop, as it's called, is widely considered the best in North America. From an opponent's vantage point, it's positively intimidating.
All right, I have no chance.
It's about 135.
135?
Yeah, that one. Maybe 125. That was like 80%. Like 100% would be a lot harder.
125 miles per hour?
Yes.
Okay.
Besides his attack offense, Wynn also has a deceptive arsenal of serves.
A good player, they have like, you know, 20 to 30 different type of serves.
20 or 30?
Yes. They'll throw it at you. Different type of spin, different type of serve. So at any one time, they can use a different one. So you're not expecting it.
For Wynn, table tennis was a major part of his family life since early childhood. Born in Vietnam, Wynn learned the popular Asian game from his father, John Wynn, who worked for the United States Embassy during the Vietnam War. Shortly before the 1975 surrender of South Vietnam, the Wynn family fled to America to escape imprisonment. Once in America, the family struggled to learn a new language and to support itself, sometimes picking cherries as a family on weekends to earn extra money. At home, John Wynn built a special Pong room for his seven children.
After work, we don't have nothing to enjoy, nothing for pleasure. And also, they are young, so we want them to do some kind of sport so that, you know, they don't smoke, they don't go out often.
Table tennis wasn't even an Olympic sport when Kwa was a child. It became one in 1988. Wynn was one of the biggest American names in the sport in the 1990s, but he missed the 1996 Olympic cut by 4 points in the final game of his qualifying match. So he walked away, figuring he'd missed his chance.
Yeah, that's definitely was a difficult loss ever, you know, I had in table tennis. After that, just focus on my career and family, and I never thought I would actually try out for the 2000. Never in a million years.
Wynn came out of retirement for the 2000 games and qualified in men's doubles. But this year, Wynn pulled off an upset and earned the right to play singles in Athens. For the entire U.S. table tennis team, the challenges of international competition will be great. Largely isolated from the world's best players in Asia and Europe, the Americans simply don't have enough experience playing against the best. When Wynn's not working at his job as a software engineer or looking after his two young daughters, he trains with anybody he can find, or at least anybody who can actually return his renowned forehand. On this day, he plays with 18-year-old Arya Melik, ranked number 4 on the junior national team. They stand about 7 feet back from the table and crush balls back and forth. Melik is superb, but he's no match for Wynn.
I can beat him sometimes if he gives me 4 or 6 points. The games are 2-11. But I can't beat him if you get it, like, normally.
Realistically, Wynn won't take home any medals in Athens. No American man has ever made it past the first round in Olympic play. But a strong showing by Wynn could mean a lot to the sport in America and get more young people interested in serious competition.
My goal is to win at least, you know, at least 1 or 2, 3 matches. If I can do that, that's definitely making history. And so the more I win, I mean, the more it's going to be help the sport and create more exposure for table tennis and take it 1 point at a time.
Kwa Wynn will play his first match in Athens on August 14th. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in Santa Clara, California.
The games about to begin in Athens cannot possibly match the ancient games, or so Australian author Tony Perrottet has written. Quote, in terms of audience satisfaction, our own revived games can hardly compare unless they were to be combined with Carnival in Rio, Easter Mass at the Vatican, and a tour of Universal Studios. That's a passage from the Naked Olympics, Tony Perrottet's new book. He joins me now from the studios of NPR's New York Bureau. Tony Perrottet, welcome to Only a Game.
No, thanks for having me.
The passage I just read suggests that competition was only part of what made up the ancient games. Tell us a little bit about its other attractions.
I think it's one of the hardest things for us to relate to, in a sense, is that the ancient Olympics was this all-consuming festival. It was very much a religious event. Sports was only one part of the attraction. In fact, the sacrifices and the rituals took up as much time as the athletic events. The other thing that's kind of intriguing is that all these other cultural events were going on in the periphery and what you might call the fringe festival. So you've got sightseeing going on, and people are running around looking at the artworks, like the statue of Zeus, a 40-foot-tall image created by Phidias, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. You've got these cultural events. You've got writers, poets, you know, painters and sculptors coming there. Herodotus, for example, debuts his famous history at the Olympic Games. He chooses it because all the most famous and wealthy Greeks are in one spot. And you've got this amazing entertainment there, the actors and the palm readers. You've got astrologers and fire eaters and, you know, philosophers standing up on their soap boxes. And the socialising opportunities are unparalleled.
Well, it's sounding a great deal like the modern Olympics to me. I mean, there's people out there selling T-shirts and probably some palm readers and fortune tellers as well.
Yeah, probably Athens will rise to the occasion. Certainly, you know, there will be this captive audience. But I don't know if they'll be able to live up to quite the extravagance of the, you know, for example, the teams of prostitutes would be brought from Egypt and Asia Minor, and these brothels would be set up in these tents where these prostitute shepherds would have these very exotic women. And so it was a very much an all-consuming event.
Yes, it sounds all-consuming indeed. Now, all these delights notwithstanding, attending the ancient games was not, I gather, for the weak or the squeamish. You write at one point, quote, "The whole experience was so uncomfortable that a master once threatened his disobedient slave with a visit to the Olympic Games."
Yeah, well, I think modern sports fans are kind of wimps. I mean, every time you open the newspaper, there's people worried about traffic jams in Athens, or that there might be blackouts, so that the air conditioning in the hotels will not function. They should take a leaf out of the page of the ancient sports fans, who are a much hardier bunch. I mean, even to get to the ancient games, you had to be pretty tough. You had to be very fit. It was, for example, if you wanted to get to Olympia from Athens, it was 210 miles, and you basically had to go on foot. Mm-hmm. If you sailed, and people were coming from Spain or the Black Sea, you had to brave pirates, and the pirates were certainly no more charitable than Al-Qaeda operatives. And when you got there, there was basically no facilities provided for the spectators. So you've got 40,000 spectators and probably as many hangers-on converging on this very beautiful little sanctuary, but it's in the middle of nowhere. It's just in this rural setting. There's three temples and some 70 altars and a running track and one hotel.
And the hotel's not reserved much plumbing.
Not much plumbing. And yes, you've got these, it's in the height of the Mediterranean summer. The advantage of that is that most people can actually just crash out and sleep al fresco. The rich, of course, would set up these beautiful tents, you know, these silk tents with, you know, their own floor tiling and artworks and things like that. The problem being that the heat dried up the two rivers that converged in Olympia. So you've got water shortages going on and you have people collapsing from dehydration and even records of people dying. No one's washing for 5 days. There's these rather pungent odours and there's no sanitation. So the rivers, the dry riverbeds, are used as open-air latrines. So the ancient Greeks were sort of used to a slightly more pungent atmosphere than we are.
Two of the most popular sports at the ancient Olympics were a form of combat in which eye gouging was forbidden, but everything else was okay, at least as I understand it. And the second was the four-horse chariot race in which you write, quote, "bloody crashes were guaranteed." Did the ancient crowds feel cheated if they were deprived of maiming and death?
You know, they were pretty well guaranteed. I don't think they ever felt so badly about it, because when you've got 40 chariots going around the hippodrome and very tight corners, it's almost impossible for someone not to take a spill and even go into the crowd on occasion. Both of these, the chariot race and the Pancration, it was called, this all-in brawl, were very spectacular events. And the chariot race, for example, if you've seen the Charlton Heston version of Ben-Hur, even though that hippodrome is in a very urban setting, whereas the one at Olympia was very rural and everyone's just standing on these grassy banks around it. It captures some of the nail-biting agony of the event and the danger and these collisions. And then, as I say, going into the crowd. So it's an unnerving event to observe as well. There's one instance where 21 chariots start off and only one makes it around the track.
Just to give listeners a further idea of the intensity of the ancient games, tell us the story of the disappointed coach whose reaction you chronicle on page 32 of the Naked Olympics.
Trainers were incredible characters in those days, and every athlete had a private trainer who would follow him around, and they were often retired athletes. And one of the things about the games, coming second brings no honour at all. That's another thing that's a little hard for us to understand, any idea of chivalry or gentlemanly behaviour. is something that the Victorian scholars really came up within the 19th century. The Greeks, if you came second, you might as well have not gone in at all. It was a public humiliation. You were basically mocked. So the idea was really to fight to the death if you could, or to the verge of death. So there is this wonderful story of in the Pancration, a guy's about to give up, and the trainer just gets so exasperated. He takes a strigil, which is was used to scrape the skin of oil after the events. He gets it and he stabs his athlete. The reason he does this is that there are many wonderful stories of athletes who won great glory, especially in the Pancration, by not giving in. There's another wonderful story about a guy called Arachion who is being strangled in the Pancration, and he's about to succumb, he's about to give in. His trainer yells out encouragement, and just as he's about to die, he grabs his opponent's ankle, gives it this agonizing twist. Now, the guy who has his ankle twisted gives up, surrenders on the spot, just as Arachion drops dead. So Arachion gets this double honor. He gets the olive wreath is placed on the corpse, and he's carried around, given full Olympic honors for the event, and his name really goes down in posterity as one of the greatest Olympic victors, because not only did he win, he lost his life in the process.
You point out in the Naked Olympics that some of the most revered poets and playwrights of ancient Greece celebrated the games and the athletes, at least the athletes who were winners, but I gather that the games had their detractors even then.
There were a few naysayers, which is quite interesting given the monolithic sort of nature of ancient Greek culture. So you have these characters like Diogenes, the philosopher, who turns up and basically he's a soapbox orator. He's going around upset that athletes are given this amazing status in society, whereas thinkers and, you know, people who are improving their spiritual quality are sort of ignored. You have Galen, the doctor, writing this wonderful treatise about young men are all going into athletics when they could be going into the legal profession or medicine, because it's much more profitable and you're given much more prestige. So Diogenes goes to the games, for example, the winner of the Pancration, that all-in brawl I mentioned. He runs up, grabs the olive wreath from his head and goes, puts it on the head of a donkey, because the donkey can kick harder, so he deserves the olive wreath more. So he's saying that this physical prowess, this, you know, this obsession with the body beautiful, with strength, speed, is philistine. It's a criticism that has been heard since as well.
Tony Perrottet is the author of The Naked Olympics, published by Random House. He joined me from the studios of NPR's New York Bureau. Tony, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. The games in Greece will give us champions and stars, and part of the fun of the Olympics is that we can't know who they'll be. Even television producers probably aren't entirely sure yet. But we do know already that these games will give us the opportunity to see some of this country's most successful and durable athletes at work together for the final time. Brianna Scurry, Brandi Chastain, Joy Fawcett, Cindy Parlow, Julie Foudy, Christine Lilly, and Mia Hamm will be playing in their third Olympics when the U.S. women's soccer team meets the Greek team on Wednesday in Crete, 2 days before the opening ceremonies. Hamm, the soccer world's all-time leading scorer with 151 goals, has played in almost 260 matches for the national team. Christine Lilly has played in over a dozen more. More important to their fans than the impressive numbers is the attitude players like Lilly, Hamm, Julie Foudy, and the rest have brought to their game. As members of the national team, some of them since the U.S. won the first Women's World Cup in 1991, they have been endlessly cheerfully accommodating to their fans. It's too bad that the enthusiasm apparent in the play of these champions and others wasn't sufficient to carry the WUSA, which suspended operations a year ago. But disappointment over the suspension of the best women's soccer league in the world shouldn't detract from appreciation for what these women have done. When they flew home, having won the inaugural World Cup in China 13 years ago, they were greeted at the airport by one writer. One. When they played China for the World Cup in 1999, there were no empty seats in the Rose Bowl. Beyond 99, there have been some disappointments. Where is the fan of soccer or of women's sports who doesn't wish the WUSA was still in operation? But the great and lasting achievement of the women's national team is showing millions of people who might not otherwise have known not only how precisely and brilliantly the game of soccer can be played and how much joy can be brought to the field, but how much joy can be reflected. The dedication of Christine Lilly, Mia Hamm, and their veteran teammates, the example they have set, has ensured that the U.S. national team will not lack for talented players when the founding class retires. But to say the women who taught a nation to cherish their effort and enjoy their game will be missed is an Olympic-sized understatement. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, tracking opposition to a new track. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On the eve of the Olympics, sprinter Calvin Harrison is off the U.S. Olympic team and will be suspended from competition for 2 years because of a second doping violation. There may be more suspensions to follow. Maybe it's time for Carl Lewis to make an impromptu comeback.
This is going to be the ongoing story right up until they turn the pigeons loose in Athens, I'm afraid. I hate to keep beating my own little tin drum here, but one of the arguments that Calvin Harrison's lawyer made was that the substance he was using, something called modafinil, was not specifically named on the banned substance list. And the United States Anti-Doping Association's answer is essentially that it was prohibited because it was chemically related to stimulants, even though it wasn't on the list of banned substances. And the argument that its director of legal affairs made was athletes are generally warned not to take drugs when they compete, and they should be held accountable when they do so. We're getting to the point now where the word prohibited has no meaning. I suppose you can just take nothing, and then that's probably what they're shooting at. But I am still extraordinarily unclear and uncomfortable about the notion and with the notion that you can be suspended for taking a substance that isn't listed as having been prohibited.
Meanwhile, on Wednesday night, the BBC will air a program that indicates that the process of deciding where the Olympics will be still is not only political but potentially criminal.
No!
Wasn't this problem supposed to have been solved after the Salt Lake City Games?
I think so. Our governor here in the Commonwealth,
yeah,
Mitt
got
Romney,
a medal for it.
Running around with a book saying that he cleaned up the Olympics. What the heck is going on?
I don't know.
Apparently, the BBC sent some people out with hidden cameras, which is the way American networks used to do journalism back when they did journalism. And they managed to solicit in these secretly filmed conversations offers, and at least one of which is quoted verbatim as saying, "It's all about money, full stop. Money in terms of cash."
The U.S. men's basketball team did manage to beat vaunted Serbia-Montenegro yesterday, and it's a good thing because our guys had not looked exactly dreamlike before that. They lost to Italy. They barely beat Germany, which didn't even make the tournament. Where did Europe get all these ringers?
Where did Europe get all the guys who can shoot? Once again, the United States Olympic basketball poobahs have managed to put together a team with nobody who can shoot from the outside. Can't we get one guy who can shoot a three-point shot, since that appears to be all the European teams have?
Charlie, we haven't spoken since Nomar Garciaparra became a Cub, so settle this for me. Is Nomar a misunderstood victim or a malingering liar?
Well, he was an unpleasant presence in the clubhouse until they traded him, and having traded him for essentially a bag of magic beans, the Red Sox are now trying to cover themselves by engaging in one of the dirtiest, lowest, slimiest public relations offensive against an individual this side of Karl Rove.
I'm wondering how the current Red Sox shortstop is going to feel about being characterized as a bag of magic beans.
Well, he's going to be characterized as that, as a bag of magic beans at the end of the year when he leaves Boston and goes and signs somewhere else, and the Red Sox wind up essentially having traded Nomar Garciaparra, one of their best prospects, an outfielder named Matt Merton, and $900,000 for Doug Mankiewicz, who the Minnesota Twins had already given up on.
Among the protesters to the trade of Nomar Garciaparra were the members of the U.S. women's soccer team, led by Mrs. Nomar.
Mia Hamm has decided that we're not going to be wearing Red Sox caps in Athens. We're going to be wearing Cubs caps,
absolutely.
I guess.
Absolutely. Here's an update on a story lots of people have perhaps forgotten, Charlie. The Augusta commissioners have voted to pay $120,000 to the attorneys of Martha Burke, who claimed the city improperly restricted last year's protest against the Augusta Nationals' all-male membership. The wheels of justice grind slowly, certainly, but did they grind out the right result in this case?
Yeah, Martha Burke finally got a win long after it would have done her any good. I mean, to be fined $120,000 because you restricted the rights of somebody 2 years ago means you essentially restricted the rights of somebody 2 years ago and have had a couple of years to accrue interest on paying your fine.
I didn't even know that Donald Trump was looking for work, but he's landed a new job. He's an official spokesman now for the U.S. Tennis Association. Good fit?
I guess. I mean, you know, he's there every year. He's around New York. You know, he's another living refutation of the stupidest thing F. Scott Fitzgerald ever said about there not being any second acts in American lives. And, you know, now that he's a TV star, he's a good spokesman for tennis.
Perhaps the most bizarre news out of Baghdad this week is that some bodybuilders there honored Arnold Schwarzenegger by staging a competition, the Arnold Classic.
Not only that, they celebrated it on his 57th birthday. And Sabah Talib, the owner of the gym and a former Asian bodybuilding champ, said, "No day could be better than Arnold's birthday."
There you go. Smarty Jones has finished running. Actually, there are people holding worthless tickets who might say that happened several races ago, but now the horse that didn't quite win.
A bitter man, Littlefield. You're a bitter man.
Did I identify myself in that category? Anyway,
sport in life. Go on.
Smarty Jones will, in fact, retire. Are you smartin' or jonesin'?
Well, I think Smarty's being treated smartly. He seems to have this chronic tendency to get bruised up on his legs. And, you know, he's worth a lot of money now, and he's one of the few horses that people are going to, like, go to Kentucky and actually go watch run around the field. So good for him. He had his month, and now he's going to do what all horses do when they retire.
Make more horses.
Yaha!
And finally, Charlie, a story that will delight you, I'm quite sure. In Mauritania, hungry locusts have chosen an especially toothsome target.
In Mauritania, the locust swarm ate a soccer field. I told you soccer was a plague. I keep telling you soccer was a plague. Now soccer has its own plague.
Suffering a plague.
Wait till the frogs start raining down at the World Cup. You won't be laughing at me.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and sinks his teeth into sports each Saturday at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Racing fans have embraced the 300-lap NASCAR event held each year at New Hampshire International Speedway in Loudoun, but that may be as far as the Granite State's hospitality toward the sport will go. Only a Game's Karen Given reports.
It's the evening rush hour in Tamworth, New Hampshire, a town of 2,500 people on the edge of the White Mountain National Forest. But not all is quiet in this northern New Hampshire town. Charles Greenulch of the citizens group Focus Tamworth illustrates the problem.
This is an aerial photo of the site. So from maybe a quarter mile up the hill from here, you can see the track.
The track is a 3.3-mile strip of asphalt at the center of Valley Motorsports Park, a private driving facility designed to give high-performance and vintage car buffs a place to play. The track hasn't been built yet, nor has the clubhouse, gasoline depot, and hotel accommodations, called Garage Mahals, planned by the developer Club Motorsports Incorporated. Stefan Kondo-Demetraki, president and CEO of CMI, has called his track a ribbon through the woods.
At the end, out of 260 acres, 45 acres will be asphalt. The rest will be green. that's a pretty small number compared to 260 acres. When you drive along the course, grass will come up to the edge of the asphalt. It's going to look like a golf course with an asphalt strip. I mean, really and truly.
Today, Conda Dematraki is leading a caravan of 5 ATVs on a tour of the site. CMI hasn't yet received the necessary permits to begin construction, but trees have been cleared along much of the proposed track. With a little imagination, those willing to brave logging roads and muddy ditches can see what CMI has planned.
The upper loop of the lower track has been cut, and what I'm going to do is I'll show you that, and then we'll probably go up just a little bit further. There's a curve here, and I really want to show you this curve.
Okay, let's drive.
After a few minutes, Conda Dematraki stops at the bottom of a steep hill. He points to the clearing he hopes will soon be the back straightaway, where cars will reach speeds in excess of 100 miles an hour. At the end of the stretch, drivers will enter a sharp banked right turn called Land's End, hopefully with enough momentum to climb 150 feet in elevation in just 500 feet of asphalt. Conda Dematraki says the turn is just the right combination of so-called pucker factor and safety, and it's exactly what amateur drivers are looking for.
And that's really the whole key behind this whole course, is it's designed for the amateur racer, not for the professional. It doesn't have concrete walls next to it that you can really hurt yourself on. Got lots of runoff area, lots of places to make mistakes.
Bob Ellis of Wellesley, Massachusetts, has just returned from his first tour of the site. Last year, he became one of CMI's first members, joining the club sight unseen. The owner of a 1985 Porsche 944, he says he's never had the opportunity to see what his car can do.
Well, you open it up, but once you hit the speed limit, you can't really, I mean, you can go a little faster. And I have gotten a couple tickets, but, you know, it's number one, it's not safe. Number two, it's not really fun, you know, because you're worried about the cop looking for you and this and that. But a place like this allows you to really hone your skills. They do have places like Skip Barber Driving School down in Connecticut, but it's, you know, it's not for a common person. It's, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 for 3 days of learning how to drive. Where here it's a club you join, and year after year you're a member, and you come up a few times a year as, you know, a family weekend, and it's a good time.
Over the past few years, many professional or even defunct racetracks have tapped into the lucrative amateur driver market, with fantasy driving schools, exhibitions, and special track days for automotive clubs. Conda Dematraki says the few tracks built exclusively for the amateur driver are running above capacity, but none can boast the amenities Valley Motorsports Park has to offer.
There are no facilities like ours that will have a 400 to 500-foot elevation change, which makes driving it, it's just spectacular. There are no other places like that in North America.
Let's face it, this isn't the perfect location for a racetrack.
Charles Greenulch of Focus Tamworth disagrees.
We're hundreds of miles away from places like Boston and New York, and those places where the people who have the types of cars and have the kind of disposable income to race them up here are probably going to be living.
Sitting on the back porch of one of Tamworth's two general stores with nothing but a ventilation fan to intrude on nature, members of Focus Tamworth are used to the peace and quiet of their small town. But that's not the only reason they're concerned about the proposed track. Steve Gall moved to the area full-time 2.5 years ago.
My wife worked with a person who lives on Old Whittier Road, which is quite close to where this track is. And when this whole thing started, she said, well, what's the problem? Isn't this like a golf club? And I said, well, it is, except the golf carts have 350 horsepower and go 150 miles an hour. It's not just this little ribbon of highway through the woods. It's the largest construction project ever considered in the town of Tamworth. It's a problem to those of us that live here. It's a problem to those of us who will see it, who will hear it, and who will drink it.
The proposed track sits atop the Ossipee Watershed, the largest stratified drift aquifer in New Hampshire, and would impact nearly 3/4 of an acre of wetlands. Gall believes Club Motorsports targeted Tamworth because it's the southernmost New Hampshire town without zoning. In New Hampshire, towns without zoning can only regulate drive-in movie theaters, amusement parks, and racetracks. So, the town drafted a racetrack ordinance that addressed noise, hours of operation, and environmental concerns. But CMI felt the ordinance went too far and asked the New Hampshire legislature to define a new type of entity called a private driving instruction and exhibition facility. As a venue without spectators, the track would be exempt from the racetrack ordinance. Before opponents even knew it had existed, the measure passed. Club Motorsports said it had no other option than to take the issue to the legislature or take the town to court. The exemption leaves Willie Farnham hopping mad.
One of the representatives that came up here said if it smells like a pig farm, it probably is a pig farm. Well, this smells like a racetrack, and it's probably a racetrack. You know, I'm a local person. I've lived here all my life, and, you know, it's just going to ruin the character of this community, totally ruin the character of this community. And it's just appalling that such a thing can go ahead and they can waltz their way down to Concord and change laws. It's just irritating, very irritating.
Some opponents point to the New Hampshire International Speedway in Loudoun with its yearly NASCAR events as a cautionary tale. And CMI's assurances that its track will be nothing like Loudoun isn't enough for Steve Gall.
With all due respect, the 70,000 spectators in Loudoun are a serious issue for Loudoun. And if you've ever tried to drive through there on race day, you understand that. But the cars that race make a lot more noise than the spectators. And the issue that we're concerned with principally, not solely, but principally, is noise. And 30 cars racing around a track make a certain amount of noise, independent of how many people are there to listen to it.
According to a sound expert hired by opponents, the track will be heard by children at Tamworth's only elementary school, by wedding and service goers at a church near the track, and in downtown Tamworth. Focus Tamworth has spent tens of thousands of dollars collected from nearly 100 members to hire two law firms, a nationally renowned civil engineering firm, a noise consulting firm, a wetland soil scientist, an endangered species specialist, and an aquifer specialist. Club Motorsports has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on its own sound study and surveys for rare plants, mountain lion scat, and hornfels, or rock chips that could be left over from the Native American tool-making process. All this is necessary, Charles Greenulch says, to protect the town and surrounding areas.
What you're seeing around you, this is Tamworth. This is what you hear most days. Point is, we know this is going to have a substantial impact on the town today. There are laws in place to control that impact. The developer has done what they can to get around those laws. And Focus Tamworth, our group, is doing our best to ensure that the laws are strictly enforced.
From the entrance to his facility, on the side of Route 25, a stretch of road that sees 5,000 to 7,000 cars a day, Condo Demetraki isn't sure what all the fuss is about. In contrast to the pristine, bucolic picture opponents paint of the area, Condo Demetraki points to the town transfer station, multiple logging yards, and oil and fuel stations that share this stretch of road. And he feels confident that CMI will soon get permission to build.
This is a process. You cannot go get permits for a construction project in one day. If we could, we'd have them, okay? See how loud that is? That's pretty loud, okay? We are going to be less loud than that. There have been people trying to build road courses in New England for about 10 years, and we did what other people have been trying to do for 10 years in 18 months.
Sitting on top of an ATV, or better yet, his Harley, Condo Demetraki talks passionately about protecting the environment. But in an effort to avoid the hundreds of opponents who say they don't believe him and can't trust him, Condo Demetraki won't likely be on hand for CMI's next legal hurdle, making the case for a wetlands exemption at the Tamworth Planning Board hearing scheduled for later this month. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in Tamworth, New Hampshire.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Toll-free, CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or take a virtual spin around the Tamworth track, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Mark Perrotte, author of The Naked Olympics, who claims the ancient Greeks had something else in common with the modern sports fan.
The ancient Greeks loved to gamble on everything. They would place bets on two flies crawling up a wall.
In fact, the words Las Vegas are derived from an ancient Greek phrase meaning waste of time and money. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.